as a soul in the alam al-dhar, in the pre-existing world, our soul could not tell Allah where we wanted to be born. We couldn't tell Allah before we came into this world, I want to be born in Calgary, in a family of millionaires. No, Allah determined where that soul goes, into what fetus. And Allah only determines that. There is no way that the actions of the mother and the father can determine that. But then you come to the end of the life, our death. Nobody in this room knows when they will die. Nobody knows where they will die. Nobody knows how they will die. As Allah says, even in Surah Luqman, that no soul knows بِأَيِّ أَرْضٍ tamut. Nobody knows in which land they will die. I've seen friends whose parents came from India to visit their family in Canada, and the father passes away in Canada. And he never imagined that he would die in Canada. He thought he would live, spend his entire life in India, and pass away there and be buried in the family cemetery. But Allah tells us, وَمَا تَدْرِي نَفْسٌ بِأَيِّ أَرْضٍ تَمُوتُ. Nobody knows where they will die. So we can't control our life, our birth. We cannot control our death, how we die, when we die, where we die, what age we die. But we control everything in between. And that's where the dua comes into a play. That's where the du'as come into effect in our lives. We have also, as we know, because we have been given that window of opportunity from the time that we're born until the time that we die, whether it's 50, 60, 70, 80 years, or maybe 15 years between birth and death, Allah gives us an opportunity to change our fate. Allah gives you and I the opportunity. He says to us, you have problems in your life? Come and I can change your problems. We, I am sure all of us in this room, on the Layali al-Qadr, the nights of Qadr in Ramadan, I'm sure we all come to a center or we sit at home and we make dua to Allah. We take the Quran, we open the Quran, we put the Quran on our head, we make dua to Allah on the Laylatul Qadr, we recite Joshin al-Kabir, we recite all of these du'as. Why do we do them? Why do we do them? It's because we hope that Allah will change our fate on that night. That's why it's called Laylatul Qadr. Qadr has multiple meanings in Arabic. But one of the meanings of Qadr, that is a night of your destiny. You can change your fate. You can change the situation that you are in. And if we didn't believe in du'as, we wouldn't show up in the centers by the hundreds, if not thousands, around the world. Allah gives us these opportunities. Laylatul Qadr in Shahr Ramadan, the three nights, the three Layali al-Qadr, 19th, 21st, 23rd, and some go 25, 27, and 29. We know that the 15th of Sha'ban, the night of the birth of Imam al-Hujjah, ajallallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, is the night of Qadr, it's the night of destiny, it's the night of dua, it's the night of changing our fate. And even every night, these last three or four nights we've been having Salatul Jama'at, we recite du'as after Maghrib, a du'a after Isha. Why do we do those du'as? Again, we're asking Allah for a change in our situation. This shows us that our teachings from Rasul and the family of the Prophet, that these du'as that they have given us are there for us to realize that there can be a change in our lives. Things are set in stone by Allah. The physical rules, the physical laws are there. But in the metaphysical realm, in the spiritual world, the dua can make a change in our own destiny.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور وغفور قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. And in this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The main source is the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Raishahri. And we have in our studio guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qum. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear sister.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So, in our previous discussions, we have been talking about self-esteem, which is a very important and crucial topic. And unfortunately, sometimes we tend to neglect it, especially with our children who are young, because we feel at that time they don't really need that respect or, you know, but we don't know that it is from a young age that if these things are instilled, then when they grow up, they will become much stronger and better. And so we have been talking a lot about this, and we spoke at the end about the do's and don'ts, and how we want this will affect the child's, you know, upbringing and increase their self-esteem.
Yeah, some do's and don'ts practical we should apply so as to enhance the self-esteem.
Yes,
and some
exactly.
Don'ts so that the self-esteem cannot go away, it can stay, right?
Uh-huh.
So one of the that we talked about was do give the child
duties.
Responsibility. It's
okay.
Very important. And then another do is do talk to them about the major changes and decisions of the family. For example, if you're supposed to shift from one house to another, or for example, if there's a decision of some people coming to live over your home,
yeah.
You know, for some time, your relatives, so talk to him about it beforehand.
Exactly.
That, you know, he should be prepared mentally. Don't let him feel surprised.
But oh, somebody
just,
come.
Yeah, dragged along the scenes. No, he should feel that these things are worthy to be discussed, and they have considered me as part of the family.
Yeah.
A child is smart enough to feel that, even if he can't express that.
Mm.
But he knows that he's considered important.
So unless you want to surprise them.
Yeah, unless you want to surprise them, for example, their birthday parties, which they would be very enthusiastic of. But no, here we are talking about major decisions and changes in the family. For example, if somebody else is going to collect them from school, we should, you know, tell them
in advance.
That so-and-so is going to collect you, so don't feel worried about it that we didn't come. Mm. Regard him as like a proper human being, intellectual human being. And another thing is, do teach him not to accept undue praise or flattery.
Uh-huh.
This is very important. The child likes to be praised, of course, but only when he deserves it, he should accept it, and that even not get gluttonous about it.
Yeah.
In the sense that sometimes, you know, a child might be praised, you know, like this happens to a person who's done a good thing, but grandparents keep on probably praising him. So he should be prepared that this, you know, why we quoted this as a do is because if he doesn't do this kind of behavior and he feels he's believing all the praises that are showered on him, it may turn to pride.
Yeah.
He may feel that there's nobody as good as me.
Mm.
So the parent should teach him that whenever somebody tells you something, know about yourself. You know yourself better than everybody else, and Allah knows you the best. So think about it. Do you really deserve this praise? If you didn't, maybe you can tell them what you did only.
Mm.
Or maybe if you did, thank Allah for it. Never even accept so much flattery. Anyway, flattery is not supposed to be done to a person because it's like throwing dust on the face.
Yeah.
As in, it spoils a person.
So we should do it in an extent where we just want to encourage them, not to like make them feel, oh, they're just too good.
Yeah, exactly. Flattery is when you spoil a person.
Mm.
You make him feel that now there's nobody like me.
Yeah.
I'm too good of myself.
So that's, for example, they win in a competition and then everybody's praising them. When they go back home, you should make it feel that you did a very good job and I'm proud of you. But now not go over it that, oh, really, there's nobody like you.
Yeah, exactly. If such things happen, for example, this competition scenario that you're saying, it's very interesting. Yeah, when they come home, the parents should now acknowledge that to the child. That, look, although many people praised you and everything, but if you go and look at it, like, who gave you all these qualities?
Mm.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave you, right? It can be snatched anytime. So never be proud of it. Always struggle for it and never even feel that you're the best. They could be out there better than you, right? So
after, like, positive that you did good, then you slowly give them a hint that, you know, but, you know, this is very true.
In future, then they would know that they would not accept praise and flattery very easily.
Just like that, yeah. Very true. Thank you very much. And we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue this discussion after that.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran, and this is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been talking about self-esteem and the do's that should be done in order to, you know, increase the self-esteem of a child. And we've been discussing about that we are supposed to do, give our children duties, tell them about the changes that are supposed to occur in the family, make them feel important, and not to accept undue praise.
Yeah. Now we come to the don'ts.
Okay.
So don't interfere in everything your child does.
Mm-hmm.
The child needs some space of healthy independence and his own originality.
Mm.
If he wishes to arrange his things in a particular way, for example, or plan something for himself, let him do it, as long as it is not wrong in a serious way.
Yeah.
So some parents expect children to do everything exactly as they wish and fuss over every small detail in the child's life. Now, such a child grows up to feel that he cannot make decisions anymore himself.
Exactly.
So give some space to a child. It's very important that when he does something, you know, let him arrange him in his room in his own way. And let him decide how to go about his timetable in his own way, as long as he is going according to his timetable.
Yeah.
Let him
decide what to wear.
Exactly. Yeah, things like that. So don't interfere with everything. Maybe you can tell your opinion if you would have won, for example, this.
Yeah.
It would be better, but now you made your own decision. He should know when he went wrong also. So he'll come to know it. You know, along the lines, he'll come to know that, yeah, this was not a very good decision. But at least that he'll be able to make his own decisions, which is the important thing for self-esteem.
Exactly.
Another thing we should not be doing, don't pamper the child too much when he's sick or hurt specially. This is very important because, you know, our heart comes out for the child that when he feels pain, you know, we shouldn't pamper him so much as it's more than what he, you know, like he needs. Deserves or he needs. Because, you know, the child would learn how to become strong and live with pain. He should be told, of course, that I'm so sorry, I know how you feel, but Allah is the healer. You'll come out of it. You're strong enough to come out. Also, you know, making him feel that now he can't do anything. He just has to rest if he has, for example, he's sick or something. Make him do things that he could do within his, you know, capabilities at that time. So that he can learn how to tackle with them in future and be strong. This gives him a sense of self-esteem that no matter what, you know, I can do things even in the hardest times of pain or things like that.
Tends to occur a lot because our children...
Or when a person is bedridden.
Yeah.
Don't make him feel that you're just bedridden. No.
You can't do anything.
Be strong and come to the bathroom, for example. Be strong and come to the dining table.
Yeah, exactly.
Join in the conversation. Make him feel that he's into it and he can do things. And struggle with his pain also and hardships. So he'll become a very strong person in future.
Definitely. Thank you very much. So we're just going to take a short break and we'll continue this discussion. Please stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back to your audience to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So we've been talking about the do's and don'ts, the do's on what we should do so as to increase the child's self-esteem, and the don'ts, what not to do to spoil that, you know, growth of self-esteem. So we spoke about some of the don'ts, that we don't have to interfere in the child's originality, and we don't have to pamper the child too much when he is sick. So you are going to tell us, I think, one more don't.
Yeah. Don't ignore the child when you have come.
Uh-huh.
When parents have company, for example, when a family has guests, Islamic akhlaq and etiquette demands that the host pay great respect to the guests, of course. But this does not mean that the children should be ignored and brushed aside.
Yeah.
Instead, the parents should encourage the child to be part of the gathering and involve him with the guests.
Introduce him to the guests.
Exactly.
Make him feel, you know.
And also prepare the child beforehand that guests are coming. So be involved. Say salam to them. You know, when they ask you something, reply to them.
Yeah.
Be good to them. Come serve to them. Things like that. So it's not as if, you know, when you're talking even with your best friend, you brush the child off. This will make him feel that they are more important than me. Although it's not the case.
Yeah.
It can never be the case. The child is the most important.
We forget.
We forget, and these small things, you know, build up like building blocks and make him, the child, feel lack of self-esteem. That if, for example, certain guests come or my mother's best friend comes, I'm neglected.
Yeah.
So he'll always feel that he's second hand. You know, he comes second in the life of his parents.
Exactly.
If they are friends around or guests around, the child should always be involved, that he is an important part of the family. There's a hadith from the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who has mentioned that Allah has decreed everything for a believer except when he humiliates himself. That's when he lacks that self-esteem. He humiliates himself. You know, lack of self-esteem will make a person, for example, not trust himself, not do important things, lag behind, moving towards, you know, the path of Allah, sin,
Na'udhu billah,
and, for example, not trust that he has certain abilities, and also sometimes they expect from people and get dejected in the process of expecting from people, because there's a hadith that says that whoever expects from the people is obviously put off, put down, because it's only Allah that one person has to expect from.
It's like a feeling like you're stooping low, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Stooping low is the outcome of this lack of self-esteem that makes you expect
from others.
Now, advantages of healthy self-esteem.
Okay.
This is not the pride and vanity again, it's just the healthy self-esteem. One of the advantages, the child who knows that he has some good qualities and that others respect him is satisfied with himself. So he wouldn't be looking out for attention elsewhere. You know, when a child is grown up, now he has developed himself mentally. So now he knows that he has some, you know, like good qualities, and he is satisfied with himself. So he wouldn't look outwards for respect and, you know, wrong kind of, the same kind of expectations we were talking about. He would expect others to respect him.
Yeah.
He would get it, but he would expect. So this will translate into rational and calm behavior.
Yeah.
He would have a calm behavior, and there will be no need for aggressiveness or to demand attention. And he'll be a happy child. If he's given that respect at home and taught all these things, he'll be a calm and happy child.
Inshallah. Thank you very much. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. Dear audience, thank you for joining us on this program. And if you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at our email englishradio@irib.ir and visit us at our website parstoday.com. Until the next program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, who are also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime. And we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income. And this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks, you know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I go, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya. Over to the skyscrapers of New York, you could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more of the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
Maliv, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there, but, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Arile and Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really, and can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer, and of course he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelio, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was, he said, well, the skills I need to run I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Mutanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Aurelio. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Aurelio's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different. So you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, you know, described it very well. Mutanda's the sort of more social, you know, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, you know, draw people in. Aurelio is much more kind of, you know, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, you know, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Mutanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that, many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's old town square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of the journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting. But I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there.
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating, and none of these characters are pristine. Relay got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives. And children by all of them. So if he's if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught, and actually the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
Lecture. Sheikh Asad Ja'fari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Lessons from the life of Nabi Musa alayhi salam has been an ongoing topic. Alhamdulillah, we continue to get through this amazing story of Nabi Musa inside the Quran. We now get to a point in the story now where, because now for a while now, Fir'aun now is quiet, he's busy, you know, he's kind of leaving Musa the way he is, because he's stuck, he doesn't know what to do, right? If he kills the man, there's a rebellion, there's a revolution. If he continues again to confront him and prove him wrong, he'll be, of course, defeated like he was on the day of the festival. So they continue now to build their community, Nabi Musa does, and the Bani Israel. The followers are getting more in numbers. The mission is expanding. And now Fir'aun now begins to destroy, attempt not to once again handle Musa. So he has a plan. He comes he brings his inner circle in together. Says, look, we can't let these things happen the way they're happening. Musa is getting bigger and his following is getting bigger. We have to squash this, right? And so they talk about ways to do it. And one thing that Fir'aun says, well, let's resort back to killing their newborn boy so that it doesn't expand. It stays where it is. Haman was his waswasa, his right-hand man, that guy who keeps whispering in his ear, who's caused him so many problems. And you'll see in tonight's episode how many of these problems that come about now in Fir'aun is because of him. He says, that's not enough. Killing the newborn boys isn't enough. You need to collect all of them, imprison them, and then in the process, weaken Musa's stance. Okay, so go there, get them one by one, all the men, separate them from the families, imprison them, and destroy this mission once and for all. Now, news of Fir'aun's newfound strategy and newfound commitment now gets back to the Bani Israel tribe. These people now, Israelites, who are with Musa. And they begin to complain. They say, look, Musa, you know, we were tormented before you arrived, and now once again we'll be tormented after you arrive. Like, what is this? Like, what is the difference between you now? We're going to, you know, Fir'aun now is coming back for us again. And that's when Musa, of course, prays to Allah. Like, to once again, you know, give them a chance. Pray for, you know, the release of the clutches of Fir'aun. Pray for their protection. God then again shows mercy on the Bani Israel tribe. Remember, this is the same tribe in Surah Al-Baqarah. In about the verses of 40 to 50, around that number, Allah says, let me remind you of what I've done for you. And we'll see as we get through the story. How does Allah now show another favor on the Bani Israel and the Israelites? He then now inflicts 7 different calamities on the people of Egypt and on Fir'aun. How many? 7. 7 different calamities. I don't have time to go through all of them. It's enough to know that the first thing that fell upon the Egyptians and all of Egypt, even the Israelites, were continuous droughts. Droughts, okay? The lack of rainfall. So the water in the Nile would dry up. They relied heavily for their crops in the water. There was no water. They would go to Fir'aun and say, look, you know, make it rain. You're the god. Right? He says, don't worry. And they reminded him, look, you are the one that said on the day of the festival that the rivers of Egypt run beneath me. They reminded them that because they're getting frustrated now. There's been days, there's no water. He says, don't worry. All of this is according to my plan. Okay? Don't worry about it. Okay? You will have your water in good time. There is my wisdom behind all of this. Meanwhile, of course, he himself is sweating inside. It gets to the point where now he begins to hear the confidence and the himmat and the strength of the people of Egypt. They actually say, look, if you don't bring about rain, we are forced now to believe in a different god. Fir'aun now says, okay, let's calm down. So this is one portion of the story that I really want you guys to understand. It's an incredible portion of the story. Fir'aun now takes them to the bank of the Nile. It's dried up. Naturally from the drought. He says, you guys go over there on that side, okay? I'll tell you what to do in terms of instructions. We'll get this water again. As they move to the other side of the Nile River, Fir'aun now being alone, he goes behind a bush or behind some sort of obstacle. He gets down on his hands. This is in Bahar, by the way. He goes on his hands and knees and rubs his cheek against the dirt. Who does? Fir'aun. Against the dirt, puts his finger in the sky. Incredible moment. In the sky, all by himself, no one to see him. Fir'aun's cheek, his own cheek, up in the sky. He says, Lord, I know that you're the only one that can bring down rain. They think it's me. actually asks God to help him bring down the rain for his people. Who does Pharaoh? Before he could lift his head off of the sand, he could hear the people of Egypt that came with him to the Nile begin to cheer. Why? It began to rain, torrential rainfall. They looked at him once again, restored belief in Pharaoh as their God. I don't know. Picturing Pharaoh on the ground, rubbing his cheek on the dirt, looking up, that inner belief now, you can hide it all you want. Eventually it comes out. It reminds me of that man who approaches Imam Sadiq, alayhi salatu wasalam, and he says, how can you prove to me that God exists? Because you're in the middle of the ocean on your boat, severe weather hits, you're about to drown. That one last hope you cling on to for life, that one voice that you think, you know what, there's no way that this voice or this entity won't help me. That last resort is God. Pharaoh's desperate. They've threatened now. We're going to leave your kingdom and go to other gods if you don't get this ring. He then turns to the inner core God that he truly believed in, but his ego, his desire, his arrogance wouldn't let him submit to that God. But things were desperate. He reached down deep down, actually rubbed his cheek on the dirt, the ultimate sign of a disgraceful slave. And God listened to his du'as, man. God listened to Fir'aun's du'as. Who are you and I? Who are you, the believers, mashallah, in the eyes of Allah, if God could relieve Fir'aun of his du'as? That moment to me was incredible. Okay, but again, the drought would come, the drought will leave. The drought will come, the drought will leave. The second calamity were hailstorms. Massive hailstorms. Now these calamities, and again, they are some are mentioned in Bahar, some are mentioned in the Quran. We'll go through the verses tonight as well. These are actually also mentioned in the Bible. The Bible refers to others, but the Quran now, according to the Hadith of the Quran, there are seven major calamities on the people of Egypt. The second and to the seventh only hit the people of Egypt. The people, the Israelites were denied or were protected from the calamity. The second calamity were hailstorms. Massive hailstorms in Egypt now would continue to just rain pour down onto the people of Egypt now. To the point where Musa sends a message to Pharaoh, I could end all this. Let the Bani Israel and me and my people go. Let it go. The storm will stop, the storm will end. The storm will stop, the storm will end. People are getting restless in Egypt. What's happening? You're the God, you're the God. So then he makes a verbal agreement with Musa. Says you refers to him, hey Sahib, hey magician, come here, right? You, if you can make all this end, this hailstorm end, right, I'll let your people go. Musa has a dua with Allah and the rain stops. But Haman now, enter Haman, that wicked Haman, comes and says, what are you doing, Pharaoh? You're gonna give a little bit of this freedom to him. He's gonna take that freedom and come back and topple you and seize control of Egypt. Don't do it. So what does Pharaoh do? Pharaoh now retreats. Right? Empty promises. Right? He's given relief now. Hailstorm stops. He's given relief now. Think about what you're doing now. I'm giving you momentarily relief through my Lord, Musa says. Right? You hold on to that promise and everything will be gone. He says, sure, no problem. Backtracks on his promise, doesn't keep his promise. The third calamity hits. What's the third calamity? Beetles. Locusts. Locusts are like grasshopper-like animals. Okay? So they say that Musa grabbed his staff, you know, pointed to the east, pointed to the west. From every corner of the earth now, these locusts, these grasshoppers, attack Egypt, attack their crops, attack their homes, just make life very difficult. Their crops are destroyed, right? Again, Musa says, let my people go, I'll stop this. He said, okay, no problem. He's given relief, he backtracks, Haman in his ear. The next calamity are beetles. Beetles come down onto Egypt, destroyed the crops. Again, let my people go. Again, he goes, yes, sure. Haman says no, he backtracks. A fourth calamity now comes in the form of frogs. God says to Musa, take your staff and strike the Nile and call upon every frog from every corner of anywhere. Frogs now come. Frogs, guys, come and they begin to attack the city, attack the homes, attack the crops, attack everything. Egypt now is seized by frogs. Frogs. Musa says, you ready to let my people go? He says, yes, I'm ready. Get rid of the frogs. Frogs are gone. Temporary relief. He backtracks again. After frogs, it's blood. The water in the Nile turned into blood. Anytime they would go to get water from the river to drink with or to grow their crops with, they would see blood. Blood. Not the Israelites, only the Egyptians. The Israelites would go to the water. That water would become water for them, pure, beautiful water. But when an Egyptian went for the water, it became blood. Are you ready now? I'm ready now. He backtracks. And then the last one is this plague on the livestock. Okay, destroys the livestock altogether. Okay, that was Pharaoh's most frustrating boiling point. Okay, all these calamities, understanding that, you know what, Musa now, with each calamity, is gaining more control over me. I'm tired. I'm getting frustrated. So what does he do now? He says, I'm done now. I'm done. Summons Musa to his courtyard. There's his entourage, his boys around him, Pharaoh's, and says that now I'm going to what? I'm going to kill this man, meaning Musa. I'm going to kill him now. I have no choice. Enough is enough. I'm going to slay Musa in front of all you guys. You're going to watch as he pleads and screams out to his Lord, and nothing will happen but the fact that I will slay him. At that moment, Nabi Musa now has a dua. Allah, protect me from the one who is unjust. Right? Protect me from the one who has takabbur, right? And protect him from what he doesn't know that's going to happen to him. All in the Quran now. Okay? So the stage is set now, to the point where the books even say that Pharaoh had his sword in his hand, ready to what? Ready to chop off Musa's head. At that moment, enter who? Enter Ezekiel. Remember Ezekiel? Episode 2 or 3 from the season? You know, sometimes they bring back those characters. You're like, oh man, where was this guy the whole time? He was quiet the entire time. He was that individual, if you remember, that individual, that when Musa killed that Egyptian by mistake, and the second Egyptian then realized that Musa killed him, he went to Pharaoh and said, Pharaoh, Musa is the one that killed that Egyptian. Find him, and then we're going to kill him. Hizqiel was the one that found Musa and said, Musa, leave Egypt. And he ended up going to Midian. But that was that individual. I refer to him as what? Mu'min Ali Fir'aun, the believer who hid his belief of God inside, who detested Fir'aun, but he was working within Fir'aun. This entire time, from the day of the festival to all these calamities, his keel was quiet. But now he's watching, moments away from being slaughtered. He says to Fir'aun, Fir'aun, you're going to kill a man who claims to be a messenger of God? And who has shown you proof time and time again of his own prophecy, his own prophethood, and the miracle of his Lord? You're going to kill a man like that? There's repercussions. And then very logically he says to Pharaoh, fine. Let's say he's a liar. Let's say everything he has said so far is a lie. That's going to come back and haunt him. But if he's truthful, then you become the liar. And if you kill a truthful man, then this lie that you're living will come back and haunt you. Okay, the way the books describe Pharaoh's state at that moment, it's almost as if he was kind of like relieved that somebody stopped him. He never wanted to kill Musa. Never wanted to kill Musa. You know, way back when, you know, when Musa and Harun first entered the palace of Pharaoh, do you remember that? And he threw down the staff and he showed the white hand. At that moment, he could have killed him, but he didn't. In fact, this whole day of festival idea, for some reason, was planned when Musa could have been killed. But for some reason, he went through so much just to avoid killing Nabi Musa. Even at that moment, he stopped immediately and had a one-on-one talk with Hilkiel. Based on that conversation, Pharaoh realized that killing him was a mistake. He let him go. Meanwhile, the one event that occurs during this time now, because right now, Pharaoh is going crazy. He's watching calamity after calamity. Now, after these 7 calamities, from the drought to the hailstorm to the beetles to the grasshoppers to the frogs to the blood to everything now, Egypt is pretty much destroyed. Okay? He has a handful of people left around him. Okay? People are just trying to make ends meet. This was Egypt, right? I mean, it was a city of like it was just a very luxurious place for Pharaoh. Everything was destroyed. صل على محمد صل على